January 19th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. We have a very, very packed agenda this morning, and we're going to try to get through as much of it as we can. Members, we are coming back at 5:15 tonight. Any bills that are not completed this morning will be carried over to our 5:15 agenda, as well as we have two other bills that are posted only for 5:15. I see we have some senators in the room who I'm sure are busy and need to get to other places, so we'll start with, I think, the things that they are here to talk about, and I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 22. Senator Walker. Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules.
Good morning, Madam Chair. It's awfully warm in here. I haven't quite figured that out. Maybe it's the most exciting place in the Capitol.
It's the heat. Definitely.
Yeah. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I am here on SCR 22 to honor an incredible person from my community who's no longer with us. She was tragically run over in a crosswalk. Our crosswalks are dangerous out there, folks. I want you to know that. Here she was in the crosswalk, leaving the hospital where she had been with her mother in the intensive care unit, and she was crossing the street with her partner, and a truck ran over her and her partner, and Lucy didn't make it, and this person had a suspended driver's license and all kinds of other things. But I had no picture of Lucy except from the memorial service until some of her colleagues sent me this picture. So I will just share this with you. This is Lucy's beautiful, smiling face, and she was an incredible employee and an incredible human being. So I don't see anyone else in the room to talk about her today.
You do have another one.
You have another one. That's great. But what I would say to you is that Lucy was a champion for social justice and workers' rights. She was a longtime Service Employees International Union. She was respected and revered by her colleagues, the administration. I know that Dr. Bruce Goldberg was devastated at Lucy's loss and posted a note to her blog after she passed away. And so I just wanted to honor Lucy's memory as I sat in the huge old church where we had her memorial service. There were probably over 500 people in that room, and I just, this was the way I could do it because I make policy. I do things like this, and you do things like this, and this was an opportunity to do that. I will also tell you that the governor's in the process also of doing a proclamation that will be pretty awesome for Lucy and her coworkers and all of the people who work so hard for us in Oregon. But Lucy epitomized the worker, the DHS worker. This is the kind of person that we actually have working in the Department of Human Services to help families, to help people pick themselves up and move forward and get the services they need, but also move on in life and stand on their own 2 feet. She had compassion. She had a heart, but she also knew how to tell people to get up and get moving. In fact, she even told a governor at one point what she thought. So Lucy and I had a great camaraderie in that respect. I've known Lucy many, many years. Can't tell you how many, but she was always there to give me advice. And I just think this is an incredible way to honor her. And you can learn more about her reading the resolution. I won't take any more time this morning.
Thank you very much, Senator Walker. And I did have the privilege of knowing Lucy and working with her through the years on lots and lots of campaigns and just
minimum wage might be one, Madam.
Two minimum wage campaigns, one in 1996 and the most recent one in 2002. And she was one of those people who was just always never too proud to do just the grant work, but added so much joy and energy to everything that she did. So thank you for bringing this to us.
She gave you no mercy on the softball field, though. she never turned away a stray animal. But she also knew how to take mental health days, which so many of us, especially us women who think we have to save the world and our husbands, We just forget about that. But Lucy was a whole person, and she got it, and it is a great loss. Yeah, we have to take care of you guys. You know that, don't you?
Okay, well, thank you again for bringing this to us.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
And I see Senator Winters in the room. We have one more witness on this. Do you have time for us to just take a bit of testimony, and then we'll get right to you? Okay, thank you, and I'll call Megan Moyer.
For the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. Chair Rosenbaum, member of the committee, I am here to speak in favor of Senate Memorial 22, memorializing Lucy Laird and her amazing contribution, not only to the Service Employee International Union, but her community and all the issues that she was passionately involved in and the work that she dedicated her life to. We really appreciate Senator Walker for bringing this forward. I think she did a really excellent job laying this out. And I just want to echo the importance that this is to us who are mourning her loss. It has been a substantial loss for our organization, and we really appreciate this effort. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 22 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Representative Berger moves SCR 22 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Holby has asked to carry this on the floor. Next, I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 26. Marjorie?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 26 expresses sympathy to the family of Audrey McCall.
And I see Senator Winters. Please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. And I appreciate this opportunity to present a memorial for one of our First Ladies of Oregon, Audrey Owen McCall. It's kind of interesting because for me, I'm very honored and humbled as I was a part of the McCall administration in 1969. Don't smile, Representative. There are those who say I'm giving away my age, but I am honored and humbled to have been a part of an administration that gave so much to Oregon. Audrey McCall was born in February of 1915, and she passed away in November of 2007. You know, we often honor the governors, and we talk about their legacy. We can't talk about the legacy of a governor without talking about the wife, and certainly this wife. Audrey McCall was a partner with Governor McCall. And when I think about such issues as the bottle bill, the beach bill, those issues that have made Oregon great, with her small petite frame, she was right there with the 6'6" guy. She also, and for those of you who know that the First Ladies, and we have one in the room with us today, are required to entertain the dignitaries and actually the 90 of us and our spouses. Mrs. McCall, because she was a home economist, and we didn't have Mahonia Hall then. They had the small house over here on Winter Street. And she would actually prepare all the meals herself. She would prepare ahead of time. She would freeze those meals. And then the day of the event, and we had to come in groups, because certainly the house nor the tent that was erected could accommodate all the individuals. It was interesting about Mrs. McCall. We refer to the McCall years as that we were part of a family. And I can still remember in 1978 when Governor McCall lost the election primary bid, and I was crying. I mean, you know, all of us who get caught up in campaigns, it become devastating when there is the loss. And she came and she put her arms around me and she said, Jackie, it's okay. It really is okay. We had 8 good years. And she was correct. She had given and worked side by side with Governor McCall those 8 good years that have given us the legacy that we talk about today. And also part of that legacy is the Department of Human Services, and I don't know how many of you know that that was created during those years, as well as streamlining state government. I'm very honored because I wouldn't be here today if it had not been for those years. The McCalls discovered affirmative action long before it was coined and phrased. They believed strongly in making certain that this building included minorities and women. And this was before we ever had any of the groups that we talk about now. And it's also interesting to note that they were part of my wedding party in 1971. So I have a real personal interest in this. But more than anything else, I believe that we should honor our first ladies. They are just every much a part of what is happening in public policy. And even after McCall passed away, Tom passed away, she continued to be involved in those issues that she believed in, and those issues were the environment. She also was involved with Norma Paulus and myself and Doris Pinwell, whom you will hear from later, as we plan to raise money to put a statue of Tom McCall here in Salem. It's kind of interesting because there were those who wanted the statue in Portland, and we probably would have had an easier time to raise the money had it been erected at the McCall waterfront. However, she was adamant that it be placed here, and her comments to us were, Tom was the governor of the entire state, of all Oregonians, and Salem is its capital, and it belongs here. And she was right. And I hope you join me in honoring the First Lady, Audrey McCall. I was very emotional when I presented this to our Senate floor, because when you've been a part of a family and you're part of the legacy that was left and a part of 2 great individuals who have given so much to this state, you can't help but, when you remember some of those days, of feeling like I did when I gave the testimony. And her son came to be with us, Tad McCall, on that day on the Senate floor. And I do hope you join me in honoring our First Lady, Audrey McCall. It's well deserved.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this to us, Senator Winters. Are there any questions for the senator? Okay. Thank you very much for being here. I'm sure we'll be moving this expeditiously.
Thank you.
To the House floor. Thanks again. And I see Representative Riley is in the room. Representative, do you have the time for us to just finish this bit of business? And okay, great. We have one more witness on this, and that is Doris Pinwell. Doris, if you could please be a little bit brief, because we do have a very crowded agenda.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doris Pinwell, and I'm here on a personal note rather than in my usual representation. I live at 529 Snead Drive North in Kaiser. I've lived in the Salem area since 1967 when I came to work for Governor McCall. I worked in his administration for 8 years, and for 4 of those years, the final 4, as his executive secretary. And in that role, I got to know the First Lady, Audrey McCall, very well, because as most people that are involved with the governor's office know, the governor's wife is very connected to what you do in the governor's office, the scheduling, you know, and issues that you address and how you address them. Tom McCall's biggest influence in life was his wife, Audrey McCall. She really, as her son says, was the rudder of Tom McCall and of the family. And She was involved with the family that Senator Winters talks about in a big way, and as Senator Winters told you, she entertained at her home. She loved having legislators and their families, but she had to divide it up. But she did do all the work herself, which is incredible to think of. I mean, a few of us came in and helped, you know, in the end, but she did all the cooking. Anyway, Audrey, though, was really influential to the governor's position on issues, and I think she was one of the, she was a very practical individual and one of the ones that kept him, made him sort of a centrist on issues. Even he had strong beliefs on, as you know, on social and environmental issues, but she seemed to be the voice of the people of Oregon on so many issues, death with dignity, for instance. And so she continued in that role long after he died, and many of you know that she had her, she was very articulate on all these issues and stood up for them as they came along in later years. So I really am pleased that this memorial is before you, and I certainly appreciate your support of SCR 26. Thanks for your attention.
Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Okay, thanks again. And Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 26 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Senator Berger. Representative, all these senators in here. Representative Berger has moved SCR 26 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Berger, would you be so kind as to carry this on the floor?
I would be truly honored.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have one more resolution, and I see that we have Mary Oberst, the First Lady, here with us. So I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 27. Good morning. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm here to talk about Senate Concurrent Resolution 27, also known as Oregon's Birthday Bill.
I know I said who you are, but...
Oh, sorry. For the record, my name is Mary Oberst. I'm the First Lady of the State of Oregon. I'm also a member of the Oregon 150 Board.
Thank you.
As you probably know, after last Thursday's events, at which I saw many of your faces, Oregon's 150th birthday is coming up in roughly a year. So I'm part of this group of volunteer board members to plan that celebration, and we have planned 5 signature projects, which I can talk to you about in detail if you want. But considering time constraints, you probably don't want. We've also created a partner program to involve community events all over the state. Passing this resolution is a key part of our board's goal to create a memorable series of events throughout the state to remind Oregonians that our state is beautiful and our citizens are very special and that Oregon's next 50 years can be truly great. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your testimony. It is exciting, even in challenging economic times. I think that we're going to have a wonderful year ahead, and certainly it got off to a great start last week in the Capitol.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this to us. Are there any questions for the First Lady?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments.
Madam Chair, I won't ask the First Lady what she's cooking us for dinner tonight.
Well... Representative Berger, tonight being Tuesday night, the menu includes leftovers.
That's what we're having. Actually, I'm always interested in an update on what the first dog is up to. What is the first dog having for dinner?
Just the usual kibbles. In moderation, of course.
Okay. Thank you again. Okay, members, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on SCR 27? Members, we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 27 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
And Representative Berger moves SCR 27 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And we need a carrier on the floor for this. Is there a volunteer to carry this on the floor?
Okay.
Representative Esquivel, we'd be very pleased to have you do that. OK. Okay, and I will close the public hearing and work session on SCR 27. I'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1071A. Marjorie.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1071A is coming to you from the Senate Elections and Ethics Committee. It was the committee bill. It has several provisions in it, and it requires out-of-state contributions to appear in a different color on OrStar. It requires treasurers to file treasurers for initiatives, referenda, or other petitions to file their transactions by April 1st if they weren't able to file them between October and December of last year. And it adjusts the OrStar reporting deadline to 11:59 p.m. rather than 12 midnight, which is actually the next day. You have the -1 amendment in your packet, which allows a candidate or a political committee to email a contributor to get their occupation information rather than actually getting that by mail.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. And I see Representative Riley, and would you like to come forward and talk to us about the amendment or anything else in this bill?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Riley. I'm the state representative for Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. And actually, this amendment has been being worked on by my staff member, Linda, for about a year trying to get this in. And it's a very common sense amendment. It would simply allow us to use email to track down contributor information. As you know, we have 7 days for any contribution that we don't have full information on to send a letter requesting that information. Some of us in the past have used, for instance, PayPal for online contributions, and currently we can't do that because PayPal doesn't give you the full information. All you have for corresponding is an email address, and the current rules don't allow email for this. So this amendment simply says a written request under this subsection may be sent by electronic mail, and it's a good amendment, and I hope you'll pass that.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. And are there any questions for Representative Riley? Yes, Representative Berger.
Probably not for Representative Riley if Mr. Lindbeck is scheduled, but otherwise I'll ask Representative.
Actually, we were originally planning to have Senator Brown, who is the chair of the Senate Elections Committee, come and give some testimony on this, and I know that they're having a brief floor session. I think she will be joining us in not too long, so I don't know if you want to save.
Well, I will put my questions out there and anyone can answer them. Okay, my question is, what is the purpose of the different font? That seems sort of silly to me. And the other is, could we not make the electronic question and answer piece by rule? Why do we need a statutory change?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, the first part of that I'm going to leave for somebody else to answer. That's not in my my purview at this point. But the electronic part, we've been talking with the Secretary of State's office, with Elon, for a long, long time, and they feel that they need a statute to put this in effect. Secretary of State's office is fully behind this amendment, but they feel they need a statute as opposed to rule.
Okay. Well, thank you for that clarification. I'm sure we'll get an answer to your other question, too.
So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Riley. And I think we'll recess the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1071, awaiting Senator Brown joining us. And let's go to how about
maybe on this one? Probably not, because I'm
Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3624. Members, you will recall House Bill 3624. We had a public hearing on it yesterday. There were some issues that arose. This is the bill that calls for some monitoring and studying of the effects of changes to the driver's license law. And so we do have an amendment that I think will address one concern that was raised yesterday. And Marjorie, do you want to explain what that does?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3624 has the Dash 3 amendment in your packet. The Dash 3 is identical to the Dash 2, except for the fact that they took the social and economic impact piece out of the Dash 2. So again, this amendment replaces the bill, and it requires the Department of Transportation to prepare a report for the Legislative Assembly reporting on the implementation of Senate Bill 1080, and it prescribes what's to be included in that report.
Thank you for that explanation. And I do see Representative Comp here. Representative Comp, are you here to talk about House Bill 3624?
I absolutely am.
Great. Well, please come forward.
Yeah.
And members, we also have some written testimony from the ACLU, and I think if we have time before Senator Brown gets here, we may take a very brief bit of testimony from that source as well. Representative Kant, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and committee. It's my pleasure to talk to you today, to come forward to testify for the record. My name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and parts of North Salem. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3624 with the Dash 3s. And during our current special session, Senate Bill 1080 passed both chambers and was signed into law last week by our governor. The new law is designed to secure Oregon driver's licenses from fraud and abuse. House Bill 3624 with the Dash 3s will provide information to legislative members as to the impact of that recent legislation. We need to evaluate the actual facts and figures to determine if the intent of the law is the result we want, or if we need to make changes in 2009. In the past weeks and months, thousands of people came to our Capitol to voice their concerns about possible unintended consequences of Senate Bill 1080. Many of those who came to testify were from my district. I am honored and privileged to serve my community and feel a duty to ensure the improvement in the quality of life, not to diminish it. House Bill 3624 directs the Department of Motor Vehicles to keep data to tell us what are the actual real impacts. This bill will assist in determining if there is an increase in the number of unlicensed and uninsured drivers, if there is an increase of hit and runs or accidents involving unlicensed, uninsured drivers, and show us if we've passed a law that makes us safer or less safe as we travel the roads of Oregon. And I noticed this morning on the recently published Dash 3s that there's an additional point about multiple passenger accidents. It's on line one of page two. That would be really important to highlight also, because many of our citizens do follow the law. They do not drive without a license, but they carpool intensely. And so if there are people that are in accidents in a van or a work car, we'd certainly want to know that if they're not insured. So I urge your consideration and support of this bill. And if you have any questions, I could try to answer those. I have a little bit of information.
Thank you very much, Representative Kant. Representative Shields has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, I voted against this bill because I had a variety of concerns and because I felt it hit the wrong target. But one of the discussion pieces around this bill was that there would be a creation of a committee to look at, say, how this might affect victims of domestic violence, how this might affect others who are might not have easy access to documentation. Has there been any progression on that idea? Have you heard anything, Representative Comp or Charles Obama?
What I have talked to is a couple of people that are attempting to organize a bigger I'll use a term that we're familiar with, big look, but not about infrastructure in our state, but the impacts of this type of legislation. And that would, the governor is considering a task force to look at multiple ramifications, not just the unlicensed, uninsured. So, yes, I spoke to several community members that were very concerned about the lack of documentation, in particular in the instances of domestic violence and abuse.
Okay. Yeah, and I think Representative Shields, I made some comments about this yesterday because I do serve on the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence. I think that there was some confusion at the hearing yesterday because a lot of things are already underway in terms of tracking some of the unintended, perhaps unintended consequences of this bill. So I think that's one issue in particular that I know there have been concerns about. I share those concerns, so I'm pretty confident that if a group is formed, we'll be able to take a look at that. And I think, did you have any additional
questions? I just wanted to get on the record that I'm really hoping the governor will take that lead in creating that task force.
Well, the record will note that. And I believe Representative Thatcher had a question.
Yes, thank you. Looking at the bill, it just looks like it's basically taking information now after the implementation of 1080 and moving forward. But it also talks about changes in the rates of uninsured or unlicensed driver, changes in the number of accidents. Are you going to be including data from before the implementation of 1080?
It's my understanding that there would be a possible assumptions made because some of this data has not been available, and so it's really going to be from this time forward to see what is the actual information so that when we come back, we will know how many of these are happening. There is some information out there, but it's not going to be apples to apples like we want it to be.
Follow up. Also, it seems like you would want to get changes in the rates of uninsured and unlicensed drivers. Are you going to be including in the study? You're not going to be doing it, I know that. But do you know if they're going to be including the information from, well, okay, I asked that, what they got on online. Well, I lost my train of thought here, I'm sorry. I had something really important.
Representative Thatcher, I think just as Representative Shields' question reflected that if you've got thoughts about what should be being looked at, I'm sure that they will be happy to take your input and try to incorporate your thoughts.
I know what my question was. Okay. The questions as to why they're unlicensed or why, were they suspended because of drunk driving? Were they just not allowed a license through 1080? Or were they uninsured because of economic factors, which has been what other states have found? Or was it because of the fact they were unlicensed and because of 1080? I'm just wondering. These are just thoughts thrown out there. You don't have to.
Well, and I appreciate that because I don't have that response, but some other people that are going to testify may well.
Great point. Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate deeply, as I was pretty adamant on removing the study of the social and economic costs. My objection is not that I'm fully in favor of a task force to look at some of these things, but I just don't think ODOT is at all qualified to do this kind of an analysis. But I do think they are qualified to do the analyses outlined in this particular amendment. So I'm favorable towards this. And I believe that ODOT is also capable of coming back and saying where, very clearly in this report, they have extrapolated data from previous reports and where they have done clear measurements. And I'm kind of putting on record that that's the expectation of this report.
Well, and I thank you, Representative Berger, Chair Rosenbaum, because that's what we need is authentic, real information so that we know exactly what has happened in the past and what is now currently happening.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Kahn? Okay. Thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you for your work.
And since we do not yet have Senator Brown in the room, I think we do have time to take comments from one more witness, so I'll call Andrea Meyer.
Look how quickly she's walking up to the podium.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in support of this bill, but urging that if some changes can't be made, that the DMV do look at other important data and report back to the legislature and all of us. Specifically, there are three big areas that we're concerned about. One is, as you all know, the Ombudsman Program has no additional funding. We think it's very important that DMV report back exactly what they were able to do, how they were able to assist people, and where they were not able to assist people, or the limitations, so that we have a better understanding, because we do believe that there is an important need to be filled and new resources need to go there, because we think a lot of folks will come, and we just don't want DMV to say, here's the Social Security Administration address and phone number, you need to go fix the problem there, or here's where you order your birth certificate from the state of Tennessee or Maine, wherever you were born. Some folks will be able to do that, but many, many may not be able to, and they'll need more assistance. So that is one area that we hope will be tracked and presented in some detail. Number two, we have significant concerns with the changing rule and law about replacement driver license cards. Under the old rule and law, if your whole wallet was stolen, you could collect some basic information, and as part of proving who you were, DMV could look at your photo on file and say, that's clearly Representative Hunt, and he's got a bill from PGE, and we will reissue. Now, under this new law and the new rules, even if someone successfully establishes their identity with all the necessary documents, and let's think about folks who are most vulnerable, homeless or low-income, and someone assists them to get these documents, and they get the ID card or the driver's license, and 3 months later, it's stolen, it's lost. They'll have to collect those documents all over again because DMV will no longer look at your photo. And ironically, it's now your biometric photo, which is supposed to be super reliable, to help prove who you are as one of the bases. So we're very concerned about that and would want that to be tracked and monitored. How many folks are having barriers when they come back for a replacement card after having successfully obtained one under this new law? And finally, needing to better understand what happens when folks go to the Social Security Administration. Concern we had with the law was that you may get a temporary card. So you have a certified birth certificate. It looks like who you are, but you have a glitch with the Social Security Administration. Your birth year is wrong. Your name isn't complete. And you need to go to the SSA office and make that change. If you don't have a photo ID, the temporary card from DMV won't have a photograph on it. So we need to know what happens with people when they're sent to SSA. How soon, how much able are they able to come back? Finally, and I will conclude, I think we need help from a lot of partners out there, folks who work with the vulnerable populations, to ask them to please keep track and assist with this legislature looking at what happens. Because a lot of folks will never make it to DMV. They won't have the types of documents. And we need folks out in the community who help folks to collect data and information so we can be better informed. So while we do urge the passage of this, it's just one step, and we hope that there will be other important steps and review taken on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And I would just point out, I think you're making some good points, and the language of this replacement amendment really does require a study for items that include the list of items. So there's nothing that precludes them also looking at how the Ombudsman Program is working and, you know, making sure that it's doing what it needs to do. So I think your points are certainly timely. Are there any questions for this witness? Hopefully brief, because we have many, many other people on many, many other bills. Representative Escobedo.
She does. Thank you, Madam Chair. She does bring up some great points. We had a lady that had a license for 38 years, let it expire, went back to get a license, and DMV would not use her photo to give her another license. And I asked DMV why, and they said, well, she may be trying to run a scam. And I said, for 38 years, this lady's running a scam? So hopefully we can use some common sense.
Thank you for those comments. Representative Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see the Governor's office represented here, and I would just hope that the ACLU would be on that task force as well.
Thank you. We would be happy to serve and help evaluate this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you, Chair.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3624? Seeing no one, members, we are in a work session. Representative Buckley, we have the Dash 3 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3624.
Representative Buckley has moved the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3624. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Amendments are adopted. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3624 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative, could you add to that motion and request that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3624-3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Buckley has moved House Bill 3624 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Yeah. Is there any discussion on the motion? Yes, Representative Thatcher?
Why are we rescinding this?
I think I can answer that for you. So the original bill, and it's replaced by this amendment, was actually the entire implementation of these changes to the driver's license program. It was the same bill that we already passed as, I believe, Senate Bill 1080. That obviously did have quite a price tag and a fiscal attached. So that was the reason why this was going to Ways and Means. Having replaced that bill now with just this, and we've also discussed this with the agency, there is no fiscal attached to this. So LFO will still look at it, but we're confident that
I was just surprised that a study wouldn't have a fiscal attachment.
Yeah, I think it's because they have said that this is something that they will be doing and they can absorb the cost of it within their existing budget. So.
Thank you for clarifying.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, on the motion, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. And Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I'd be delighted, Madam Chair.
Well, okay, for now, we'll assign it to
I'm
you.
I'm happy to pass it along to anybody you'd like, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll figure that out before we get to the Okay, thank you very much. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3624. And let's see what we've got here. For members of the audience who might be here following House Bill 3615, we will not be taking that up this morning. The amendments are not ready. We will be taking it up, however, this afternoon at 5:15 at our hearing. So that will be carried over. We have now two more bills, including the elections bill that we started on. We are awaiting Senator Brown for that and the other bill. So I think what I will do at the moment is briefly open a work session on House Bill 3603. Members, this is the mortgage lending bill. We will not be working this bill this morning because we are awaiting amendments on that, too. But there were a couple of people signed up to testify yesterday that we didn't get to since we got evicted from our room by the very important and busy Revenue Committee. So I think what we'll do is have that public testimony, and perhaps that'll bring us back to the other two bills that we can work today. So I will call up Pam Levitt and Tim Martinez. And although we're in a work session, we'll take your public testimony. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning, members of the committee. Madam Chair, thank you so much for letting us come back today and provide some brief public testimony. And I will be brief because, I'm sorry, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We will be brief because many of the comments that were made yesterday, we certainly agree with. I just want to briefly commend Representative Holvey and Bonamici for their work. I sat with them through many hours of the Mortgage Lending Task Force, and they did a wonderful job. That task force was called by the governor to come together and provide a variety of solutions to what is considered the mortgage lending problem. We came up with two bills, three concepts that are moving through this body that we think address some of the immediate concerns. I do expect and I hope that that mortgage lending task force will continue to meet through the 09 session. A comment was made yesterday that the mortgage lending task force decided not to do anything on lending practices, and I respectfully disagree with that comment. We had one subcommittee meeting on lending practices, it certainly, we realized that there was going to be needed a lot more time to discuss and debate solutions moving forward. Do you need us to
Well, actually, Senator Brand has just joined us, and we do want to hear from you. So if you, I know that you said you had to go, Pam. Do you have
any questions? I have until about 9:10, and
okay,
I have to
wait. I think this will work out. No, I think this will work out perfectly. So I'll recess the work session on House Bill 3603, and I will reopen the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1071, and I will simultaneously open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1098. And we are very pleased to have the chair of the Senate Elections Committee with us this morning, and we actually, Senator, did hear a little bit of explanation on Senate Bill 1071, so if you could start with that and tell us
great,
what you want us to know about the bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I'm sorry, I thought you guys were waiting for me, so I ran down. Senate Bill 1071 does three basic things. It makes out-of-state donors listed in the Aura Star system in different colored font, closes a reporting gap, and changes the reporting deadline from midnight to 11:59 to clarify when reports are due. The purpose of the color coding is to make it easier for voters to see where political donations are coming from. It requires out-of-state donors to be listed online on the online reporting system in a different colored font. We all, I think, support Oregon's initiative system and the public's right to pursue these initiatives, but I certainly support the public's right to know who's funding these measures, how much they are giving, and if they're giving to support or oppose a measure. And the public's right to know means including easily and readily going online and being able to see where the money's coming from. It also applies to candidates as well, and I'll give you three circumstances under which it might apply. For example, your grandfather sending you a donation from another state, business in another state sending you a donation, or an organization, for example, if it was organized in Washington, D.C., would also be included. So the what would be out of state is the considered the address on the check. I talked about the reporting gap. Under present law, some contributions and expenditures by petitioner committees that occurred between October and December will never be reported. The bill corrects that omission, ensuring that all campaign transactions are reported and protecting the public's access to all campaign activity. And the movement from midnight to 11:59 is to clarify, apparently midnight is actually considered the next day. And so we have broad support on that particular provision. So urge an aye vote. Happy to answer any questions on this one. Do you want me to move to Senate Bill 1098?
Are there any questions on this bill? Yes, Representative Thatcher?
Yes, thank you. Representative Riley kind of brought up something to me. He was talking about offering an amendment that would allow people to email request for information on what a person that contributed did for a living.
Senator, this is the -A7 amendment. I don't know if you had a chance to
see it.
But it leads me to this, because he says you're not given complete information when you accept donations through PayPal, and that's why you cannot mail it to them, because you don't have their address. You only have their email. So how are you going to determine out-of-state contributions through those that are just emailed or donated through PayPal?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I don't know the answer to that question. So you're talking about donations that are given online?
Right.
I assume those are primarily given through credit card number, and the credit card has an owner, and the address would be either out of state or not out of state. So.
Yes, Representative Berger?
I had emailed
the chair. Am I reading this correctly, that the it's the Secretary of State's office that does the font coding, or
that's my understanding, Madam Chair, Representative.
So Parker. If that doesn't happen, there's no penalty to the filer.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, actually raised a really good point in terms of constitutional issues that were raised in terms of imposing an undue hardship or burden on out-of-state donors. Because we're not actually imposing the burden on the donor from out-of-state, there shouldn't be any constitutional issues. So, because it is coming from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you.
Sounds like you had a thorough discussion of this on the Senate side. Okay, so why don't you move on to the next bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 1098, as you can probably tell, we gutted the underlying bill, and the bill basically does three things. Under present law, the county clerks can receive a voter registration card as long as it was postmarked. Well, here, let me put it a little differently. What was happening is the county clerks were getting thousands, they say, of voter registration cards after the 20-day cutoff deadline, which wasn't a problem so much for the registration piece, but it made it very difficult for them to turn around and get ballots out. So what this bill does, number one, is require that a voter registration card must be addressed to an election official for it to count when it's received after the 21-day deadline for the cutoff time for voter registration. The second thing is, under current law, a voter must explicitly request a new ballot when they actually change their address within the county, and we delete the requirement, making it easier for the county clerks to simply send the ballot to the new address within the county, so the ballot will be automatically sent to the voter. And the third thing it does, it allows the Secretary of State to collect information from the Postal Service to provide counties with information to update the voter registration database, and it also allows the county clerks to update the voter registration database. I believe that all three of these provisions will help streamline, should save us some money, and should speed up the process. So, happy to answer any questions, but I know there's a bunch of certified smart people behind me that can answer them better than I can.
Any questions for Senator Brown? Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your courtesies.
And actually, I did have a question about the second bill, and I don't know if it's for you or for the Elections Division, but my question was just the requirement in this bill that we make use of, or the Secretary of State make use of, the post office information to update the, I guess basically the database that the state is maintaining. Do you know if the voter gets notified if there is a change that comes through the post office so that they can make sure that the post office information is correct? I ask this question because I've had some personal experience since having an address in Salem as well as one in Portland with mail that gets forwarded and sometimes doesn't get forwarded and sometimes totally disappears. So not to cast aspersions on our wonderful postal service, but I just wanted to make sure that we're not changing somebody's voter registration address without their being aware that a change is being made.
Madam Chair, that is a very good answer, and I'm getting from the nodding heads in the back of the room that the answer to that is yes. So both from the Secretary of State's office and from the county clerks.
Great. So. Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification.
Thank you.
Thanks again for being here. Okay, members, I think we are now in work session on two bills, so we might as well move them out of here. The first of these is Senate Bill 1098A, which does not have amendments, so I will entertain a motion. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1098 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley has moved Senate Bill 1098A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Is there a volunteer to carry this bill on the floor? I think we've had almost everybody this morning assigned to carry a bill. Representative Shields. Okay, Representative Shields will carry this bill. And now we are also in a work session on Senate Bill 1071A. Did members have all the discussion that they wanted on this bill already?
If I could clarify on this, I think Representative Thatcher brings up a good point in terms of on the amendment. I think the amendment's required. I've received PayPal contributions, some from two blocks from my house, and others I have received out of state. And you do have to track down the person because you don't get that information through PayPal. And email, they do give their email address. Mm-hmm. So that is really the only way you can do it, as far as I know. So.
Yeah, I just want to say I'm not opposed to emailing, being able to email. those people who have contributed, and you don't know what they do for a living.
Right.
But it just seems like it doesn't mesh well with this new requirement to make out-of-state contributions a different color, because they could be out-of-state contributions and you wouldn't really necessarily know it. If that's true, what you're saying, I haven't received contributions over PayPal, so I don't know.
You still need to, when you file the contribution, you still need to put the address of the person who you get the contribution from, as well as their employer. That's still the requirement for reporting, so... that's the only way you can track it down is the email. You can look people up, even Google people's names. It's actually pretty frightening how quickly you can get people's personal information by just Googling the name. And gives you kind of guess from where you might locate them. But email, you can ask them on email what their address is, who they're employed by, and report that when you report the contribution.
So with that clarification, because I think the answer is correct, that every contribution that you accept, no matter where it comes from, has to have a source identified, and that source has to include an address. So from wherever you get that information, you have to provide it.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I guess I did have more questions about, like, well, when you have a big out-of-state contribution coming to a 501c3 who turns around and donates it, and it's looked at as a local contribution, you know, in many cases, like, I don't know, a Soros Foundation contributing to our organ, and they're contributing to whatever campaigns and initiative campaigns or whatever, or to defeat a mission of campaign. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like that's really, it's a little buried, and I'm not sure if this is really going to clarify all that much.
Well, I don't think this bill does, it makes any change to that situation. It seems like you're describing situations that more go to where does anybody get their money? Where does Diane Rosenbaum get her money before she contributes it to something else?
I guess my point would be that the straight out here donating directly from, say there's a local arm of something that's located in Texas,
sure,
and they have, you know, that's where the money gets contributed from the states, it gets pooled there, and when they go directly to the candidate, it's looked at as an out-of-state contribution. Whereas if they went through some back door, they can make it look like it's local. And I don't know. I just don't think that it's just looking like somebody's being painted as, oh, look, they're receiving out-of-state contributions. And when I just feel like it's more of a political thing rather than really clarifying for people that information is available. But it just is. It's just, I think, I'm not sure if it's solving any problems. I'm not sure if it's really accomplishing anything other than maybe painting somebody with a brush that isn't deserved.
Well, I will take that as discussion on the bill, and thank you for your comments. So we are in a work session, and we do have an amendment that needs to be adopted. Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, I move the -A7 amendments, or -7 amendments to Senate Bill 1071A.
Representative Buckley has moved the -7 amendment to Senate Bill 1071A. Is there a discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Representative Berger?
Discussion. I think it's a good idea.
Okay, great. Any objection? Amendment is adopted. Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1071A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves Senate Bill 1071A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, further discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
I think it's perfectly silly to have it in a different font and a different color, but there are good things in this bill, so I'm going to support it.
Well,
thank you for your comments. Any further discussion? Representative Shields.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, if you would like to work on something that might keep, say, the Scaife Foundation from donating to FreedomWorks and then passing money through, or other possibilities, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Well, it sounds like our interim work plan is taking shape already.
Well, a list for you too.
I see a subcommittee forming already. Yes, Representative Hunt.
I do not want to serve on that subcommittee. But it seems like the worst case scenario is we get a lot of these out-of-state groups to start opening up accounts in Oregon banks and credit unions, so that sounds like a win.
it could be promoting business for some of our witnesses that are in the room. Okay, I think there is no further discussion, so we're on a motion. I'll just ask the clerk to please call the roll on this motion.
Representative Estimel?
Yes.
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Hunt, I think you are the only member who has not volunteered to carry a bill today. Would you like to carry this one?
You bet.
Great. Okay. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1071, and I will reopen a work session for the purpose of testimony only on House Bill 3603.
I don't know how you have to make sure you get perfectly silly into it. Not just silly.
I noticed I was not asked.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon, again with additional testimony. I was talking about the mortgage lending work group process, and I just wanted to say that we have a great precedent that was set in the 2007 session with the Identity Theft Task Force. We sat down for 8 months, worked out many complex issues word by word, and came to the 07 session with a bill that was supported by a variety of different groups. I would encourage you not to pass legislation during a quick special session on lending practices so that we can, A, wait for the Federal Reserve to come out with their guidelines. Our credit unions are currently responding to those guidelines. They go farther than your amendments to House Bill 3603, and also give the State Mortgage Lending Task Force an opportunity to work. The last point I want to make is that credit unions are smaller financial institutions, and having complex laws both at the state and federal level are difficult for some of our smaller institutions. If you pass a different state lending law than what the Federal Reserve comes out with, we've got some of our credit unions with one or two compliance staff that it's difficult to figure out how to comply with two very complex lending legislation. So that's all. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I do have to head to Portland for a 10 o'clock meeting, if that's okay.
Great. Well, thanks for hanging in with us so we could hear your testimony. And Mr. Martinez, thanks for being so patient.
Sure, Madam Chair, thank you very much. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I never thought I'd be sorry to see Pam leave, but I'd be happy to try to answer those questions for you as best I can. Mr. Marquis yesterday and Ms. Levitt today kind of stole most of my thunder on the comments I wanted to make, so I will be brief. We do echo what they've said, especially on the work group. I still scratch my head to see what the rush is in February. You do have a work group in place. You've passed or will pass two very good bills with three concepts in them that will make a difference to folks today in Oregon. Those they talk about the number of people that may go into foreclosure this year in Oregon, and it is an awful thing for them and for our economy and for all of us. But the bill that you have already moved out of here, and hopefully the Senate will do the same, the governor will sign on foreclosure consultants, will help. It will make sure that people don't lose their homes to a scam at this late date. The other bill that you're doing that adds additional regulation to mortgage brokers is also something you ought to be proud of. I mean, it is going to make a difference going forward. It is a good piece of legislation. So again, we question the need to do the lending practices now. As Pam mentioned, the 583 work group was a model that we thought we were going down the road as we got involved with the governor and his task force on the mortgage issues. I would just point out, we don't often testify very politically up here, but I would just point out on the identity theft work group, which was Senate Bill 583, we came to all the major decisions prior to the 06 election. So we were in that room in a very bipartisan manner trying to come up with good legislation. And what you passed in 583 in the 2007 session, frankly, is a model. I know several of us in the lending industry and in other industries use this model as we go around and talk to our colleagues in other states. We believe we can continue that and do the same thing with lending practices. The other piece that kind of is we believe very important is the Federal Reserve. When they are involved, their comment period is over before the end of April. We had some, I heard some testimony yesterday about how long they will take. I would just suggest to you very strongly that they will have something in place by the summer. Now, I realize some of you believe, as do many of us, that they were a little late to respond. Well, they're making up for that now in spades. They will definitely have something. We believe that it will be very workable. And just remember that they're the only group that can have regulations that apply to all of us, to PAM, to banks, to mortgage brokers, to mortgage bankers. They're the only group that can do that, right or wrong. We hear all the time, state versus federal, but in this case, it's very clear that they're the group can do that. And that kind of brings up my next point is that, as Pam mentioned, you do have a choice, either a credit union or a bank, in where you charter yourself. You can be federally chartered or you can be state chartered. We believe both are healthy choices and are made for different reasons. Many banks take the state charter if they're only going to be located in a single state because you can form a lot better relationships with somebody, nearby. Most of the large institutions, however, do take the federal charter, although we have within two blocks or three blocks down the street here a Pioneer Trust Bank, which is a small local bank. It's been in business probably close to 100 years maybe here in Salem. They chose a federal charter. I point that out because we are hearing now from banks around the state that if this bill were to put them at too great of a disadvantage, they would certainly look at swapping charters. And that's certainly their choice. And I just throw that on the table. Because when my office is also several blocks down the street here, and I have the privilege now of walking to the Capitol, which I enjoy. But as I walk to the Capitol, Willamette Valley Bank, state chartered. I pass U.S. Bank, federal chartered. I pass West Coast Bank, state chartered, on and on and on. In the disclosure section of this bill, or the prepayment section of this bill, and again, I think I heard the chair say there's going to be further amendments. Doesn't sound like we're going to get a chance to review them prior to this afternoon, and I would just go back to the work group. That's why the work group worked. We had a chance to vet things, to look at things, to discuss things. We haven't had that chance on these bills. On the Senate side, we had our national folks looking at Dash 1 and Dash 2 in an afternoon, and that evening they passed out Dash 9, which we had never seen. So, again, just from a fairness perspective, we think the work group is a great example. But I digressed briefly. When you go back and I pass the banks that I walk by every day, I think about this bill, and, let's just talk about disclosures. The feds have a very specific set of disclosures. I would invite all of you the last time you either bought or refinanced your house to think about the stack of paper that you signed to get that loan. Every single piece of that paper was put in for a good reason. But very few of us actually take the time to read each and every one of those pieces of paper. So what you're asking under this disclosure is that state chartered institutions use the federal disclosures and also any new state disclosures. Now, you are going to have, that is going to be a burden. If I walk into a federally chartered bank and say, I'm interested in a loan from you, give me your disclosures, and I get one set of papers, and then I walk into a state chartered bank and I get a different set of papers, I'm comparing apples and oranges. And I thought the goal here was for everybody to look at apples and know what they're looking at or what they're potentially getting. So I put that out there. Same thing with prepayment penalties. We were very fortunate, the lending community, to meet with Speaker Merkley the other day. And so you're talking Pam Leavitt, Tim Martinez, Mike Dewey, Paul Cosgrove, Matt Marquis, and I'm sure I'm leaving, and John McCauley. Half of the folks in that room told the speaker that we had indeed taken prepayment penalties in our loans. We did that because our lender said, I'll pay all your costs. I'll pay your appraisal. I'll pay all your closing fees. I'll pay all your costs. But in exchange for that, you tell me you're going to keep the loan on the books for a set number of years. Half of us did that. Now, I would just close by saying that gets back to the whole issue in my mind of financial literacy. We continue to push, Pam has pushed as well, we will push in the 2009 session for this institution to do more educating not only our kids, but adults on how to make a good decision. Wouldn't it be a great place if Oregon, you could go into any place and get three different offers on a mortgage and know exactly what the three offers were and could decide for yourself which was a good, the proper loan package for you. So I will stop there, but I would just leave it again with the issue of state versus federal chartered, and I would, you know, just give you a partial list, and you'll probably, as I go through the list, figure out how I came up with this list. But when you look at Albina Community Bank or Premier West or People's Bank of Commerce or M-Bank, Representative Hunt left before I could get that one out, or Willamette Valley Bank, those are folks that we're going to have to go back through the association and say, you know, this bill is going to set you apart from your other competitors in the market. And if I can have just 30 more seconds, Madam Chair, we talk about what we're going to do going forward. I will provide this committee, and I apologize for not having it today, the six biggest lenders that probably have over 50% of the market, right? Bank of America, Countrywide, WaMu, Wells, and I'm leaving out two, have just announced last week a one-call program where you call your servicer. If you're more than 90 days delinquent, you call your servicer, and they will, if 90 days is obviously a long time, they will take some information, and within 30 days, they will see if they can refinance you into something else. Now, the key to this is, do you have the ability to repay? Now, that's still an issue. It's not, you know, if it's too far down that road where even readjusting your mortgage is not going to make it work for you, that's not going to happen. But there are, the release I saw, there are hundreds of thousands of folks that are in this situation right now, and those servicers, those lenders stand prepared to do whatever they can to help those folks. So I will make copies for all of you to take a look at that, but I would just encourage you to understand that there are things happening out there, and this legislation is premature. We ought to let the work group do its work and see where the feds end up. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I had a question for you, and I wonder if you know or could get this information. What number of or percentage of the banks in Oregon are state-chartered versus federal?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to get that information. My guess is, and Linda Navarro, the president of the Oregon Bankers Association, is in the back of the room, so hopefully she'll nod, but I would think between 90% and 95%.
Are federal?
Our state chartered.
Our state chartered. Right. So the vast majority are state chartered.
But Madam Chair, I think the other question is whether deposits based, and it's probably, and again, maybe she'll nod, 80 to 85% are probably in federally chartered institutions.
Most of the money is in the 10% or so that are federally chartered.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And I know Pam is gone. You don't probably know the answer to the same question for credit unions.
Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay. And other questions for Mr. Martinez? Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope you give me just a minute here, because Ms. Martinez obviously knows the subject very well, and hope you can clear up some confusion for me. And I noticed you were using a Macintosh laptop in the back, and so obviously we have that in common, so we can establish this communication here. But Ms. Martinez, I'm confused, I just got to say, and let me kind of frame this question this way. I listened to the testimony yesterday, read the bill. It seems like what we're trying to do is very simple. We're trying to make sure that no Oregonian, between the end of this February session and whatever we do with in 2009, falls into a loan that they cannot pay, and it has a negative impact on their financial future and their family. That's basically all we're trying to do. It seems to me it's extremely simple to say, here's prepayment. Here's a concern about prepayment. The feds might be going even further than we're going, but I don't see the harm for our state saying, okay, the feds might go further, though Representative Esquivel and I come from a timber county that's still waiting for D.C. to get back to us on that issue. The feds might go further, but they might not. That's in the future some way. I don't see where the harm is in terms of having a two-year prepayment period with the 60 or 90 day deadline for the homeowner to be able to refinance. In terms, that seems like a good thing for the consumers. In terms of the disclosure, it also seems to me that we are very intelligent people. We're obviously working in the financial industry, and if I can figure this out, and if I can look at this and say, well, this is state, this is federal, here's the rules for prepayment here, here's the rules for payment here, here's a disclosure here, here's a disclosure here, it doesn't seem that complex to me. So I know there's been an argument made that this makes, you know, two sets of standards, but they're not hard to understand, and as far as I'm concerned, the more disclosure, the better. I would like to see bells, whistles, and fireworks go off when they get that stack of paper and they get that piece of paper with the disclosure information. I'd love to see it just explode and say, wah, 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 you might want to pay attention to this. And I would like to see that in every loan package that comes through that might have this kind of impact on consumers. So help me out if you can. Tell me exactly why, given that I really can't see that it's too complex for financial institutions to figure this out, and since the feds are not acting now but may act in the future, why it is somehow damaging to Oregon consumers to have this protection that's offered in this bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, there's a lot of questions there, so I'll try to get through
them,
and I know you'll help me if I don't get to all of them. I guess the first thing I would say is we do believe the federal government is acting now. You know, they have proposed regulations out for comment. That is acting now. That's not something they're thinking of doing. They have them out. The comment period closes in about 45 days. I guess I would respectfully disagree on the disclosure piece from this perspective. I don't know that you've heard in this committee, but your colleagues have heard in Chair Holby's committee, and we heard certainly in the Senate side on their committee, that many people got into this situation because they weren't aware of what they were getting. They had the disclosures, but they weren't aware of what exactly was going to happen. So I would just respectfully, you and I can read those disclosures and understand what they're saying. There are many people, unfortunately, that do not have the financial literacy to do that. And those are the ones, in many cases, that were harmed. You also did see, though, however, in the media, some examples of some investors and others in Portland and the Oregonian a couple of weeks ago that rolled the dice. And, you know, they did know what they were getting into, but they bet wrong. You know, they thought the home prices were going to go like this forever, and they bet wrong. So the disclosure piece, yes, the financial institutions, banks, credit unions, and others can certainly do that, but you're talking a fairly expensive process to modify those for Oregon only, and that would be what would happen if we had a separate disclosure for Oregon. Most of this is done. I mean, I think one of the reasons I believe that we have such a huge stack of papers to do that is because of Apples and PCs, where it's very easy to now create a form. If we still had to handwrite everything out, I bet you our disclosure pile would be a lot smaller, or type them out. So, you know, we signed up for a process through the work group. We're committed to that process. I believe absolutely that work group will come up with some language on prepayment penalties. Absolutely. Disclosure, I don't know. Again, it's going to depend on what the feds do. But the risk from our perspective is if we get out of line too far from what the Fed does, that in January of 2009, you'll be back to either undo or fix this legislation. And our argument is you don't need to do that. You talk about what, you know, we want to make sure no Oregonians are hurt between now and January of 2009. We certainly agree with that. Virtually all the products that got us into this situation are not available. You know, there's nobody out there. You know, interest rates are at a very low point again. But it is very difficult. Lenders are very skittish at the moment. You know, they're looking at the A paper customers. And beyond that, they're skittish. They are very skittish. If you talk, I don't know if the realtors or the home builders are in the room, but if you talk to them, it's not that simple right now to go in and qualify for a loan. So I guess from our perspective, we find it very unlikely that in the next 8 or 9 or 10 months you're going to see a replay of what got us into this mess at any level, because we're still working our way through it. The bad actors, the ones that the really bad actors, are out of business. The institutional investors are not looking to buy mortgages, securitized mortgages anymore at this point. And we believe we have time. We believe we have time. We ought to see what the Fed does. We ought to bring the work group together and work it out similarly to what we did on identity theft. Again, I think that was a great example, and that's what I believe many of the folks that signed up for the work group when the governor asked, that was kind of the model we were looking at. Did I get all your questions?
Mr. Martinez, I hate to cut you off, we're almost out of time here. I did want to address one of the questions that you seemed to raise, and that has to do with the amendments that will be forthcoming on House Bill 3603. We do not have those amendments, but I know that as soon as I get those amendments in my possession, the committee administrator will have them in her possession. They will be distributed to the members of this committee, and at that point they are available to any member of the public who seeks them through committee services. So, and I will tell you, and I think this did happen over the weekend, that the amendments that we were hearing and taking testimony on yesterday, I know Representative Holvey took some extraordinary steps to get those in electronic version and tried to get them in the hands of stakeholders yesterday. In fact, I would warrant that the stakeholders probably saw those amendments before the chair and members of this committee saw them in many cases. So we are certainly not trying to do anything in this committee on such an important subject to avoid public scrutiny. That's, we're really committed to that.
Well, and Madam Chair, I appreciate that. I actually did have a copy of the amendments, I think, Sunday afternoon or evening. Yesterday, for many of us in Oregon and around the country, was a holiday of some sort, so it was difficult to get any response from, especially when on a bank holiday, to get any response from folks about these amendments. I guess I would just ask, if I could, with all due respect, are you just tweaking, whoever's proposing these amendments, are they just tweaking still the same two issues, or are you adding, subtracting from the policy piece? Is that possible to know the answer?
I can't tell you, the ironclad answer, but I think they will be substantially similar. Okay. So they're still dealing primarily with those two issues, the two issues being prepayment and disclosure.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so stay tuned. Looks like Representative Shields had a question he desperately needs to ask.
I'll just ask one. Mr. Martinez, how do the proposed federal rule restrictions that are being commented on now on prepayment penalties compare to the restrictions on prepayment penalties in HB 3603?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, if he's in the room, I'd like to invite my counselor, Paul Cosgrove, to take that question. Is he back there?
He is.
Coming forward.
Madam Chair, Paul Cosgrove for the record. Representative Shields, I believe the current federal rules have prepayment restrictions under Truth in Lending Act that say no prepayment penalty can extend beyond 5 years. I believe what the current proposal in the rules is to change that so that in addition to that restriction, there is also a restriction that the prepayment must end at a time period prior to any reset of interest rate on an adjustable rate mortgage. And I don't have the rules in front of me right now. My recollection is that that is a 60-day before any reset is what the Fed is considering. They're accepting comments on those rules, and they're getting a lot of comments about a variety of other changes to prepayment, but that's what they have published as of January and what people are commenting on. Thank you.
Okay. Any additional questions for these witnesses? Thank you very
Thank
much
you,
for your
sure.
testimony. So, members, we are coming back at 5:15, and we have two bills that were previously posted, plus we are carrying over two bills from this hearing. Those two bills are the one we were just talking about, House Bill 3603, as well as I'm hopeful that House Bill 3615, the amendments will be back on that. We'll get those out to you as soon as we get them. But do please show up at 5:15 for your opinion, because we've got some important bills we need to get out tonight. I will recess our hearing, and that will have the effect of carrying everything over to tonight. We are in recess.
Thank you, Madam Chair.